the headlines this hour. Iran says that it is following up the cases of its nationals detained in the U.S. who are being held in dreadful conditions and under false pretext. The Italian ambassador to the Democratic Republic of the Congo is killed in an attack on a United Nations convoy. And thousands of Algerians rally in the capital and other cities to mark the second anniversary of the anti-government protest movement that ousted longtime President Abdelaziz Bouteflika. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran says the fate of Iranian nationals detained in the U.S. has always been a priority for Tehran, and that it is following up the cases seriously. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said most of these prisoners are being held in dreadful conditions and under false pretext. He said this cruel policy is a legacy of former U.S. President Donald Trump. The spokesman said the new administration has not still taken any measures in this regard. However, he said the U.S. has sent messages to the Swiss embassy in Tehran, as well as other envoys, to resolve the issue. He said that Iran's proposal of exchanging prisoners with the U.S. is still valid, referring to a 2018 proposal by the Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif. The Iranian parliament and government are at loggerheads over a deal reached with the International Atomic Energy Agency to monitor activities of the country's nuclear sites. Parliament says the agreement violates a law that calls for ceasing the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. But the government says the accord is in line with the legislation. Political commentator Sam Mehdi Torabi believes the rift shows that Iran has a vibrant democracy.
Actually, it's basically the government implementing the law and the legislation that was passed by the Majlis, which is the duty of the executive branch. The executive branch has a certain amount of leeway in which way it wants to implement the law, which is fine. That's part of the normal processes of governance and government. It did it in this way. As we saw, also, Majlis had some complaints about the way it was implemented, which is, again, a normal process of a healthy, vibrant, democratic republic. The Majlis made a decision to send its complaints to the third branch, which is the judiciary branch, in order for these differences to be settled. And so I think actually it was quite a good day in terms of showing to the world that Iran is a place where there's a rule of law. Iran is a place where decisions are made in a rational manner, where the different branches have their separate duties and they do the things they have to do under the Constitution. And there's no such thing as an impasse. If there's issues comes up, there's always a way to resolve them.
The Italian ambassador to the Democratic Republic of the Congo has been killed in an attack on the United Nations convoy. The Italian Foreign Ministry said in a statement that Luca Attanasio was shot dead near the eastern city of Goma while traveling in a car with a convoy of the UN Organization Stabilization Mission. Italian policemen and a driver were also killed. The Italian President Sergio Mattarella has condemned the assault as cowardly. The European Commission also expressed concern over the situation in the African country.
The news are extremely worrying, and we are following the situation closely with the EU delegation in DRC. The HRVP has reported this to the FAC and presents its condolences to Italy, to the UN, and to the victims of the violence in Congo.
No group has yet claimed responsibility for the assault. Local authorities say the attack was part of an attempt to kidnap UN personnel. The UN World Food Program says that a number of people in the convoy were also wounded, but has not given any further details. Dozens of armed groups operate in the area where the incident took place. Max Civilli says that according to local rangers, the attack on the UN convoy in the Democratic Republic of the Congo was an attempted robbery.
Basically, it seems it was an attempted robbery, according to rangers at the local Virunga National Park. As you said before, Luca Attanasio, the Italian diplomat, killed, died in an hospital of gunshot wounds to the abdomen after arriving in a hospital in critical condition, and the carabinieri and the policeman, Iacovacci, was a 30-year-old man from a small town south of Rome. He had been serving at the Italian embassy in the Democratic Republic of Congo since September. And the envoy's car was part of a Monasco UN peacekeeping mission convoy, and it was attacked with light weapons by a terrorist commando. And as you said before, Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio voiced immense grief after learning of what happened while he was at an EU foreign minister's meeting in Brussels. He said Italy would make every effort to shed light on the incident.
Algerian police have clashed with demonstrators who hit the streets to mark the second anniversary of the country's anti-government protest movement. Thousands of protesters marched across the capital Algiers while police tried to disperse them. Police checkpoints have also created heavy traffic. In February 2019, Algerians embarked on a nationwide protest campaign against the government of former President Abdelaziz Bouteflika. 2 months later, the longtime ruler was forced to resign. However, protesters continued their movement, demanding a sweeping overhaul of the ruling system. The rallies were suspended last March due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Time now for the news review of this bulletin. The European Union has agreed to impose sanctions on four Russian officials in response to the jailing of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Two EU diplomats who broke the news said no names were discussed, as the bloc's four ministers agreed on the sanctions. But they said the bans are likely to hit Russia's director of prisons and prosecutor general, among others. This comes after Moscow called on other countries, including the U.S. and the EU nations, to stay out of Navalny's case, calling it an internal issue. Kremlin critic lost an appeal against his 3-year prison conviction this week. He was detained on February 2 for violating a 2014 parole, a charge that he denies. Our correspondent from Brussels, Jerome Hughes, joins us. We also have John Ross, who's a senior fellow at Chongyang Institute, who joins us from London. So, Jerome, Russia has made its case very clear when it comes to Navalny, that, you know, it's an internal issue. And yet you have the European Union that has imposed these sanctions on Russian officials. Are the reasons given by the EU purely the Navalny case?
Well, listen, it's an ongoing campaign by the European Union against Russia, and we have the same campaign being run by NATO, and it's well documented, and we've reported on it so many times. And as we heard today from the EU foreign affairs ministers, they're meeting today in Brussels, and this morning as they went into the meeting, each one of them gave statements, and it was full of anti-Russia rhetoric, but mainly in relation to, in this particular case, the Navalny situation. And, you know, it's rarely highlighted or ever, you never hear it highlighted in the Western mainstream media here, that, as you mentioned in the introduction, this prison sentence given to Navalny is relation to, you know, breaking the terms of a 2014 suspended prison sentence. And it's like any country with a judiciary. If you break the terms of a suspended prison sentence, it becomes a prison sentence. But, you know, this is never highlighted. Also, they accused him, they accused Russia of poisoning him last August. And Russia, the Kremlin, has been saying, show us the evidence, show us the lab tests, show us the lab results, show us the medical evidence for this. And we have the situation where the EU countries involved at that case last August, they will not give any evidence to the Kremlin. So it's the same old case, and we've seen a similar situation in the past in that regard as well. And then you have how the Western mainstream media report on the protests. You know, we have the Navalny protests in Russia, and the people involved are portrayed as heroes, and they're looking for justice and so on. And the media here never mention the fact that we're in a global pandemic, and it's the same in any country. If you have large crowds gathering for protests, there are going to be arrests. I mean, even today, there were cases raised with the European Commission of alleged abuses by police in Spain. We've seen it right across the European Union. We've seen it in Belgium here, when protesters get together at a time of a national pandemic or an international, a global pandemic, there are going to be arrests. But the way all these details are treated by different media organizations is really, it's striking to say the least. And, you know, so it's all one way, it's all anti-Russia, and the whole thing. We just don't get the full picture whatsoever. And there are a few, they are in the minority, but there are a few EU lawmakers who do highlight that this man that we're talking about, Alexei Navalny, he's certainly no angel. He has a very shady past. He has very questionable support. So there's a lot of behind the scenes apparently happening in terms of trying to trump up support for him, which is being funded by Western powers and so on. And so this has been highlighted in the European Parliament by a few EU lawmakers. But, you know, I also, by the way, I have some statements here from the EU ambassador to the from the Russian ambassador to the EU, which I can give you, or maybe you want to speak to our other guest first.
Okay, let me just ask him. When you take a look at this, John Ross, I'm guessing that it's not just about Navalny here, that the issue runs deeper when it comes to the EU and Russia. And I believe that what really jump-started all this was the way that the whole Ukraine situation went down. What is the end game that the EU is looking for when it comes to Russia, do you think?
Well, there's a long history of intervention by the EU and the United States inside Russia. I lived in Moscow from 1992 to 2000. And in 1993, the Russian parliament was attacked with tanks. You know, there was heavy machine gun fire, shelling, and many people killed. And this was by President Yeltsin against the Russian parliament. And the United States and the West supported this. Extraordinary things happened. And then you've had interference over such questions as the questions of Crimea. Anybody who knows Russian history knows that the Crimea has always been part of Russia. It was only removed from Russia by an absurd decision made by Khrushchev. And if there was any ever referendum inside the Crimea, as there was, it would be won overwhelmingly, which it was. The people of the Crimea don't want to be part of the Ukraine. I mean, it's simple. It was 300 years they're part of Russia. So what you have is therefore an attempt to force the population to live in a country that they don't want to live in by force. And that's a pretty drastic intervention into the affairs of a country. So this is only one part of a very, very long record. And as was said, Navalny is not actually the biggest opposition figure in Russia. I mean, the Communist Party is actually by far the biggest opposition organization inside of Russia. But I don't notice the West playing that up. They just seem to play up people who are favorable to the West. So the whole thing is a pattern of interference in internal affairs.
Okay, Jerome Hughes, you wanted to continue maybe perhaps with what you wanted to say before.
Yeah, just briefly, Vladimir Shizov, who's the Russian ambassador to the EU, he has been making comments, and, you know, he doesn't like to call these sanctions. He likes to, because he says only the United Nations can deliver sanctions. He calls these restrictive measures or whatever. But he says the actions are illogical, strikingly politicized, and taken under far-fetched pretexts. And he says Russia is a reliable and responsible partner and will not slam the door in response to these actions by the European Union. And he says if Russia does respond, the actions will be based on facts and analysis rather than assumptions and emotions. So, you know, Russia's, and we've interviewed Ambassador Shizov many times, and he always makes the point that there is potential for great relations between Russia and the European Union, but for whatever reason, whoever is sort of cranking the machine in the background, you know, that just never comes about. And so it's just one issue after another, and any opportunity to beat Russia with a stick is taken by the European Union and by the United States.
Final question goes to you, John Ross. We have seen the way that the EU has treated Russia when it comes to respective countries, for example, Germany. We can talk about the Nord Stream 2, or maybe you can, of how that's going down. Also, the way that Josep Borrell actually went to Russia looking for the COVID vaccination, the name of Sputnik 5, of which Ursula von der Leyen has been faulted for not being able to handle the distribution. Are certain countries within the EU okay with Russia, but not the EU itself?
Well, there's relatively divided. As you said, the relations are very complex. If you take Nord Stream 2, this is a pipeline under the Baltic to supply Germany with gas at a much cheaper rate than the liquid gas it would be thought to import from the United States. So the United States has, however, been trying to persuade Germany to instead import liquid gas from the United States for a higher price. It's in the interest of the United States. This is a pretty drastic interference in the internal affairs of Germany and against its interests. Yeah, there's quite big divisions within the European Union on this. On this particular case, unfortunately, what has happened is they've got together behind a person, Navalny, who's not very reputable, who's not a major opposition figure inside Russia compared to people who are opposed to the Kremlin. And this will create a lot of problems for the European Union inside Russia. Because I lived there for 8 years, I've got many friends in Russia, and they think this is completely disgraceful interference in their internal affairs. So the whole thing is actually completely counterproductive, even from the point of the EU. They should just stay out of the situation.
Okay, thank you very much for that. That's John Ross, senior fellow at Chongyang Institute. John, it was a pleasure to see you. Correspondent there from Brussels. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back. The World Health Organization slams wealthy countries for not only hogging COVID-19 vaccines, but also undermining the pathway for poorer nations to get them.
Some high-income countries who are actually approaching manufacturers to secure more vaccines, which is affecting the deals with COVAX, and even the amount that was allocated for COVAX was reduced because of this.
The WHO chief said the world body can have vaccines delivered to the countries that are members of the COVAX program, only if rich countries cooperate, respecting the deals that COVAX did. Tedros urged high-income nations to make sure that the request for additional jabs don't undermine those deals. This comes days after the UN warned about the high levels of vaccine inequity and inequality. The UN has also voiced alarm that just 10 nations have administered 75% of the doses so far, and 130 countries have not or have had none at all. Yemen's Ansarullah movement and Saudi-backed former government delegations have wrapped up the latest round of prisoner swap talks without reaching any agreement. Head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners' Affairs says the failure is due to the continued intransigence of the Saudi-backed delegation. Yemen's Supreme Political Council has also said the failure confirms the party's lack of seriousness toward any solution. The correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, has more.
After weeks of negotiating in Amman, the head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners' Affairs says the talks have ended without making any progress due to the inflexible approach of the delegation of former government backed by Saudi Arabia. The committee says it has made several proposals to overcome the differences, all in vain.
There are many reasons that caused the failure of the negotiations, including that the other party presented new names that did not exist before and changed the list that was agreed upon. Another reason is that the Islam Party, one of the parties affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition, wants to free its members only. A third reason is that they don't have one delegation to negotiate, but rather multiple delegations representing different parties affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition.
A member of the Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Al-Houthi, described the Saudi-backed delegation's refusal of swap deals as a crime. He said the failure of talks is a message from Saudi Arabia and its allies that they are not serious about any solution that may end the suffering of the Yemenis. He said their calls for peace are not in line with any real action. More than 15,000 Yemenis were captured in battle fronts by both warring sides since the beginning of the war in March 2015. Of these prisoners, only more than 1,000 were released in 2020. Under a UN brokered deal, while hundreds of others have been freed through local negotiations.
The release of thousands of Yemenis from Saudi prisons needs more efforts by the United Nations to pressure the representatives of the former government and the Saudi-led coalition to stop hampering the swaps. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to the program, Ulama Speech. In today's program, we're going to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi. Please stay tuned.
گاهی گفته میشه یعنی اون حرکت سریعی که یک تحولی در جامعه ایجاد میکنه متعمل خود این حرکت از بین میره. گاهی انقلاب یعنی این، گاهی انقلاب یعنی اون کسانی که این انقلاب را انجام میدن و نتایج.
At times what is referred to as a revolution is a quick movement which creates a change in the society and then it slowly ends. Sometimes this is what is meant by a revolution. Sometimes a revolution means those who conduct this revolution and then protect the revolution's results for themselves. And that is when we say this is the revolution of these people. And sometimes we have a much more comprehensive meaning. Such as a revolution is like a country where it has different preferences, different beliefs, and different types and classes, to the extent where they all accept it and they don't back out from their opposition. The revolution has a context, that this revolution which we have today is the result of that movement. This is what we say. This Islamic revolution has a system. It has laws. It has stipulations. It has delineated powers. It has a constitution. This is what we mean by revolution. Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hi everyone, this is your host John, and I welcome you back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program focuses on the South Asian region and aims to address critically important issues, particularly of the subcontinent. This region hosts almost 25% of the global population, and with the help of our team and experts, we will try to discuss, dissect, explain, and analyze issues which affect the everyday lives of the people living in this diverse melting pot. Please stay with us.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we delve into the largest protest in the world by Indian farmers that's been going on for months with no break and no end in sight. And we will discuss the reasons behind the protests and its repercussions for the country.
Indian farmers began their protest last year, and it's gaining even more momentum this year. The farmers are protesting against three farm acts which were passed by the parliament last September. These acts, often called the farm bills, have been described anti-farmer laws by many farmer unions, while some see them as necessary measures for the future of the industry. Farmers say they want reforms that wouldn't leave them at the mercy of the corporates.
Indian farmers started their protests locally soon after the government announced fundamental changes on how agricultural products are produced, stored and sold throughout India. About 2 months into the protests and no practical response from New Delhi, farmer unions, notably from Punjab and Haryana, began a movement named Let's Go to Delhi to make the government hear their voices. At this point, tens of thousands of farming union members have embarked upon a march towards the nation's capital. But late in November, a nationwide general strike gathered approximately 250 million people in support of the farmers, while hundreds of thousands of farmers were converging at various border points on the way to Delhi.
Farmers, mainly from Punjab, but also joined by others, the farmers in Punjab, it's a basically agricultural community, and Punjab provides rice, wheat to almost the rest of India. It's a very fertile land, and they grow. They are very hardworking people, so it is their life and bread. And now, with the passage of some laws in Indian Parliament, they see it nothing less than attack on their livelihood, because if they are left at the mercy of the big corporate houses without proper safeguards on the minimum support price, then they think where it will eventually end. And they are a proud people, Sikhs are proud people, their diaspora is scattered all around the world, and they are very resourceful. They don't want to be heading to a future where they see that they will be humiliated, and they have at the moment, they are producing a lot, they live a good life, and they don't want to be going to a future, pushed to a future which they see miserable for them.
Modi is anti-farmer in the hands of the corporates. So he is changing these laws for the corporates. So it will be definitely not in the favor of the farmers.
I came here on the basis of humanity and with the belongings to all my brothers and sisters, the farmers who are sitting over here from last 2.5 months. I feel so much depressed, so much regression for the government, for the Modi government, that they are not even listening to them.
Late in 2020, the government tried to end the protests through some minor changes on new pollution laws and dropping amendments to the new electricity ordinance. However, about a month later, in late January, the protests entered a new phase when tens of thousands of the farmers held a parade with a large convoy of tractors towards Delhi. The tractor rally deviated from the planned routes permitted by the police and turned violent. Many people were injured or arrested as the protesting farmers drove through the barricades and clashed with the police.
The Indian government vehemently maintains that the changes in the agriculture industry are not only necessary, but also way past due. However, farmers, especially those with smaller lands, need reassurances that the new policies would not crash them into poverty. Proponents of the measures, mostly Modi supporters, argue that the reforms will make it effortless for farmers to sell their produce directly to big buyers, and insist that the protests are based on misinformation. To clearly see all the angles to the problem, we have to look at the agriculture in the subcontinent through a wider historical and political perspective.
following the anthropogenic Bengal famine back in 1943, when the food shortage killed over 3 million people, India began taking steps to prevent another disaster and end the country's reliance on foreign food aid. India kept expanding the amount of farming land until 1967 and the beginning of the Green Revolution. Under premiership of Congress leader Indira Gandhi, it converted traditional farming into an industrial system due to the adoption of modern methods and technology, such as the use of high-yielding variety seeds, double cropping, tractors, pesticides, fertilizers, and huge government-funded irrigation projects. Then comes the golden age of the Agricultural Produce Market Committee, which was created to ensure farmers are safeguarded from exploitation by large retailers. The committee made a set of regulations that ensured prices do not reach unreasonably high levels and guaranteed timely payments to farmers for their crops. In exchange, farmers were only allowed to sell their agriculture produce in designated market yards called mandis. This was the preferred modus operandi until Modi's reforms.
India has a long history of farmers revolting against the rulers. In British India, farmers famously held protests when colonial rulers wanted to force them to grow opium or indigo. Currently, over 600 million Indians depend on the agriculture industry, and the sector constitutes a hefty chunk of the country's GDP. But over 85% of India's farmers own lands smaller than a few hectares and are especially vulnerable against private players and giant landowners. Modi, who had promised to double farmers' income by 2022, is on course to help big corporations render their way of life obsolete and push them deeper into poverty.
Farmers do not trust government's assurances for a fair sale system or a guaranteed minimum price for some essential commodities. It is understandably difficult to believe a government that clearly favors a national framework for agriculture sector based on modern models at the expense of smaller players. But it is impossible to believe in the well intentions of a government that orders police and law enforcement of various states to attack the farmers' gatherings with water cannons, batons, and tear gas. The government has charged union leaders with sedition and built massive concrete blockades around the farmers' congregations outside New Delhi. It has cut internet, electricity, and water to make life unbearable for the farmers who have blocked the road to the capital. But these hard-working people already had precarious lives.
Nobody can be blamed except the government itself. The government is doing something which is against its interest and against India's interest. So ultimately, they will lose, and none of them will benefit. At the moment, some opposition parties are supporting farmers, and they may get some temporary benefit. They may get more in touch with people, or they may enhance their presence in public. But that is a temporary gain that won't last. Actually, nobody in the system will gain.
They now find their current jobs and their future at risk, and know that given the shrinking economy on the backdrop of the devastating impacts of the pandemic, alternative careers wouldn't be emerging. They do not seem to be afraid of the cold or hot weather, and most likely they won't budge until the laws are repealed.
Already enraged that the farmers keep defying the government, Modi and his ruling Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party became extra furious when international celebrities started to raise awareness about the plight of the farmers. Now, the government has allegedly resorted to measures like arresting activists and blocking Twitter access for the farmers, as well as weaponizing an army of internet trolls to attack anybody who supports the protests. Such moves have backfired and further morphed the protests into a wider movement against the government's authority.
I find it interesting to see the response that is coming from the BJP supporters and the supporters of India's ruling party on Twitter. to Rihanna's tweet, for instance. They're asking, is Rihanna Muslim? Okay, so they're displaying their Islamophobia and their fascism to the entire world.
Farmers don't seem to be yielding to pressure as they have made a new home along the highways to Delhi. They are living in makeshift settlements or camping tents and have even created malls and a newspaper, Trolley Times. The Modi government has delayed the implementation of the laws for 18 months, but the farmers say they keep protesting until their demands are met. The unions have brought water tankers for the protesters and say they have supplies for 6 months. Farmers, who are perhaps the most patient people on earth, can probably live there forever. Economists have talked about these reforms for decades, but nobody had dared to initiate them. To transition to a more diversified modern economy, India needs to generate non-farm jobs. But over 1 million jobs should be created every month just to stay in the same place. This not only threatens Modi's political future, but also in an ultimate test of India's democratic structure.
This is the problem with that part of the world, and of course India included, that they understand democracy as a sort of dictatorship of the majority. Whosoever is in majority, they can do anything, which is not true. Democracy means that they have to govern the country and take people along with them. It is a participatory form of government. And that would mean that when the people to whom the law relates, when the people come out in protest, government tells them that we have done something good for you. They say, no, you have done something bad for us. Now, in this situation, they should talk. And there have been more than one session of talking. Nothing is coming up because government is not budging. Government is not doing anything which can solve this. So if the farmers are not happy, government should... It should go through again, and it should see if the laws are in the interest of farmers or not. And if not, they can repeal it. There's no problem that government should not stand by its prestige. That's not a proper pro people way of governing the country.
Modi's government, which has been recurrently accused of steamrolling dissent and showing no respect for minorities, is in a peculiar quagmire. These protests have gathered people from different religions and castes in the same camps, a rare scene in India. Farmers have brought forth the democratic urges of all the people that have been suppressed increasingly over the last 6 years.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we now have Ms. Mercy Baker, who is an economic analyst from Leesburg. Ms. Baker, welcome to the program. So, why have the Indian farmers been protesting for months, and what are their demands?
Well, the farmers in India have been moving on the streets in protest since November 2020 up through February. After last year, the Modi government pushed through three new agriculture laws. They signed them in September, and they open up the farmers' income to gouging by the major world food cartels, that is Nestle, Unilever, and many others, and overturn the decades of farm support mechanisms for the farmers, of how their prices can be determined, how their agriculture products are marketed. So this is intolerable for the farmers of India, and they've taken to the streets to say these laws must be cancelled.
Okay, so these protests have been going on for months, like you said. What did the government exactly do to upset these farmers that they've come across going on for months? And what has it done to address their issues?
Now, the Modi government has had at least 10 meetings with leaders of the protesting farm groups from November through early February in 2021. But the Modi government, with the cartels, the agriculture cartels behind it, it only has offered to suspend the three new offensive agriculture laws for 18 months. And the farmers say, no, they must be canceled. There must be a system in India that's in both the interests of the farmers and the non-farmers of the 1.3 billion people.
Ms. Baker, before moving ahead and asking you other questions, let's just take a quick look at how the global media has covered this situation, and then we can continue.
Farming employs more than 50% of India's workforce. Many feel the sector is in need of an overhaul and modernization, in particular so it can adapt to the challenges of global heating. Indian farmers, 85% of whom own fewer than 5 acres of land, have long struggled with poverty and debt, and suicide rates are high. In 2019, nearly 10,300 farmers killed themselves. This isn't the first time that large protests have rocked India, the world's largest democracy, but this time it poses a unique challenge for Modi. Agriculture is the primary source of livelihood for about 58% of India's 1.3 billion residents, and farmers are the biggest voter bloc in the country, making farming a central political issue. Angering the farmers could see Modi lose a significant chunk of votes at the next general election in 2024. It is a question of farmers' livelihood, do or die, said Dharmendra Malik, a spokesman for the influential Indian Farmers Union. Since the violent clashes between protesters and police on Republic Day, Modi has taken a tougher stance, calling the demonstrators part of an international conspiracy. The BJP has also sought to stoke divisions among the farmers, likening the protesters to kulaks, wealthy peasants targeted as exploitative class enemies of poorer farmers in the former Soviet Union. Over the past few years, however, the rise of right-wing authoritarianism has brought India's democratic standing into question. India has plummeted in democracy metrics across the board, including the Press Freedom Index, where it now ranks 142 of 180 countries, 4 spots behind South Sudan and 3 behind Myanmar. The Human Freedom Index ranks India at 111 of 162 countries. This past September, human rights group Amnesty International ceased operations in India following sustained assaults from the Indian government. Indian police arrested environmental activist named Disha Ravi in the southern city of Bangalore for allegedly helping activist Greta Thunberg for what they are calling a possible criminal conspiracy to support the months-long farmer protests in India. Indian authorities said the woman shared an online toolkit, which Thunberg initially posted on Twitter, that describes ways people can help and bring attention to the Indian farmers who are demanding the repeal of new farm laws.
Welcome back, Ms. Baker, and thank you for staying with us. So, Ms. Baker, moving ahead, you talked about cartels and the government only offering to suspend the law for 18 months for the farmers as a relief. But, of course, that's no use for them, so they didn't agree. I'm wondering, what is the global impact of these protests and what do they represent?
The farmers in India who have taken to the streets in protest are actually fighting against the cancerous system that's run out of Wall Street and London, that's based on cartel control of basics like food and energy and based on speculation. So what they are up against in India in the farm protest is fighting for the principle of the sovereignty of national government to determine what kind of pricing to have and what kind of production in the agriculture sector should exist. This has been traditionally called parity pricing. It should be fair for the farmers, and it will be food security for the other non-farming citizens alike. Every nation has that right.
Okay, who are the most affected by these reforms? Who will be benefiting from the protests or the chaos in the sector?
Now, the farmers who are protesting in India are suffering hardship with their families, but they are protesting for a principle. So they are part of the front line in the world against the cartels and the impoverishing of farmers and non-farmers alike. India represents a great deal of world food production. It's the biggest, it's the second biggest wheat and rice producer, a big cotton producer. So any disruption to India's agriculture affects the world, not just Indians. And finally, the only benefit out of this is some wrongful benefit by the opposition parties to Modi. Instead, there should be an agriculture policy in India that benefits all of Indians and part of the world picture.
All right. Thank you so much, Ms. Baker. It was nice having you here with us. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we had. Now, let's see how people on social media have reacted to the protests across India.
Preeti Chaudhary blames those who are silent on the protests and considers them as the helpers of the powerful. Also, Navu criticizes those who are not with the protests and actually calls them the suppressors of the people's voice. This tweet by Rihanna, the famous American celebrity and singer, attracted considerable attention among the Indians and was very well received by them. Richard Wolf refers to the Indian general strike and suggests that the AFL-CIO should also mobilize American workers to protest the same policies in the US. Harja Bangal believes that neither the new laws nor the previous system is in the interest of the farmers and they need to be repealed and reconsidered.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was our episode about the largest protest in the world by the Indian farmers. We'll meet next week.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.